as stakeholders, you have made presentations, and today we are going to get responses from Treasury and SARS on the submissions that we received from yourselves as stakeholders. Pardon, I see Mercedes Benz and NAMSA. Are we having presentations today? To the other stakeholders. So we have to be fair to them. Because we are told today we allocate you 30 minutes each. So we're so we'll start with Mercedes-Benz South Africa. You have got 10 minutes to present, then followed by now. You will introduce yourself and then just speak to the slides. You don't have to, read because we have the slides, the presentation. With us here. Thanks. You are welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Good morning, everybody, ladies and gentlemen. Before we start from our company, Mercedes-Benz South Africa, I would like to introduce myself. I'm Andreas Engling, CEO of Mercedes-Benz South Africa, working in South Africa now for roughly 3 years, and it's an honor for me to be here today. Before I show you a few slides about the impact of the proposal and amendments to ad valorem, I would like to hand over to Dr. Nozipho Badil. Dr. Nozipho Badil is one of our independent directors and board members of the MBSA organization. Nozipho.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Nozipho Jani Vadal indeed, and I've been on the board of Mercedes for the last, this is my fourth year. And I am here today, I suppose, wearing both my hat as a person who is So my presence at the hearing today is really both wearing the hat as a board member, but also as a South African citizen. Because I think if the laws that are being amended did not compromise, if they compromise the interests of our country and the National Development Program, certainly would not be here today. So I think it is a year ago that the Mercedes-Benz announced a $10 billion investment in South Africa when the President reached out and invited all of us to participate in his first investment conference. And there's one coming up again. And I just wanted to highlight one or two things that I feel certainly, and in our discussions, the amendment of this bill in the way it is currently proposed would not serve necessarily the interests of both the company as well as the country. First of all, Mercedes-Benz produces the vast majority of vehicles for the global market. It does not only produce for a local market. And there would be severe on costs to Mercedes-Benz should there no longer be the prevailing duty offset mechanism and resulting in significant reduction in production and export volumes. So just in terms of volumes, there would be an impact. MBSA is also not just competing amongst OEMs in South Africa, but also competing with other global Daimler plants. So it is part of a stable or part of a network of plants across the globe. Which are also producing for the international market. The rebates that are earned through the incentive programs partially compensate for other disadvantages, for example, the cost of labor, transport costs, as well as infrastructure in South Africa. and this that would otherwise not be as competitive to our plants in other countries. And these include, for example, production networks in Vietnam, in Romania, Thailand, and Hungary. And then the proposed changes in this regard will then significantly impact the local vehicle market, which is already in a declining state. So we really feel that the timing of this change is perhaps not at the best time for our country, as the economy is declining, and of course our sales are also declined. We have with the APDP, which the company has been working with. We understand that it's coming to an end, and it will be replaced by the successor, the South African Automotive Master Plan, and which aims to make South Africa's automotive industry globally competitive. We would like a conversation that goes a little bit further. One where I think all the interest groups are aligned in the way in which they see the implications of this of these changes. And in that regard, because we only have 10 minutes, and I'll give over to Andreas to take over and give you a little bit more detail, we do implore that you relook these proposed changes and that the policy changes will negatively impact on Mercedes-Benz's ability to remain competitive with its global counterparts. And its ability to create opportunity for further localization and job creation in the South African market. We cannot afford to lose more jobs in our country, unfortunately. But at the same time, we understand that there is a need to expand the fiscus, but we feel also that perhaps we could consider thinking it further so that the different stakeholders have the same understanding of what is going to happen and make a win-win decision that will serve both the country and the company.
Thanks. Thanks, Nozipo, Chair. So I want to jump now in my presentation to give you some more details about our business, about our company. As I mentioned that, so we have two locations, a production plant in Islanten in the Eastern Cape area, and also the marketing and sales responsible business located in Pretoria. So we are looking back on a long history in South Africa. We are producing here in South Africa for more than 60 years, but that is not what I want to focus on today. So I think we have to focus on the current situation and also what we've done in the last 2 years. So only giving you a few facts and figures. So we are the leading debt-listed entity on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And in the last 2 years, we spent roughly 160 million euros for supplier development from our company. We spent more than 150 million euros in skills development. We established a learning, Mercedes-Benz Learning Academy in 2016, where we qualify not only our employees, we also offer this qualification service for the whole supplier industry that are interested in. We spent roughly 110 million euros for enterprise development and also 80 million euros for socio-economic development. Looking on the tax side, so income tax paid by our company around about 1 billion rand in the 2016 to 2018, corporate tax 2 billion rand, and customs duties around about 3 billion rand. And that is especially looking at the Eastern Cape area, a very important figure. We created more than 4,000 jobs in our production environment. And in addition to that, looking at tier one suppliers, looking at the supplier industry, we are talking about roughly additional 30,000 jobs that are working behind us. The next slide, please, shows why is it also so important, to talk about the impact of ad valorem at the moment. We will see if we get changes in this ad valorem tax, we will see definitely an impact, a big impact in our business. And here the landscape should show something, so that is especially as a production plant or production business very important. So we are not, so our competitor is not sitting here in the room looking at the colleagues from maybe BMW or VW. So our competitors are inside our own company. And that shows this landscape here. So only using two KPIs that that shows so that are, so we are in a yeah, maybe not so comfortable situation as we were 10 or 15 years before. Using one example, so that is the green, yellow, and red flag positions, looking at labor costs. So labor costs are much cheaper at the moment, and there are new competitors. They haven't been on the market 10, 15 years ago in Eastern Europe and also in Asia. So if you, and also Nozipo mentioned that, if you compare South African labor costs with, for example, Romania, Romania is 50% less to South Africa, and if you look in some Asian countries like Vietnam or Indonesia, that is much cheaper to produce here. There, also looking at some comparison input factors, maintenance costs, IT costs, freight, big topic for us. We are 10,000 kilometers far away from the market. We have plants producing in, for example, Eastern Europe and Germany. They are close to the market, and we have to compensate all these additional costs with our product costs here from the South African plant. And that is back to where we came, where we started the discussion, or where I wanted to start the discussion. Every impact on increasing costs in the production business will directly have an influence on the competitiveness to other plants in the Daimler production network. As I mentioned that, so next slide, please. The most important impact that we see when we look at the changes to ad valorem, so we will definitely destabilize the Mercedes-Benz activities and the industry. Bearing in mind so that we as an automotive industry, and we contribute 7% to the GDP, we will see, so when we are not competitive enough, a significant reduction in production and production volume, but also that directly is linked to that in export volumes from here to the markets all over the world. We will see decreases in local vehicle markets, and also Nozipo mentioned that the situation at the moment is definitely not the best one. Last slide, and I think so that is how can I say that? So that makes it very clear. So if we lose volume, if we see these decreases in the incentive program of the South African government, so that from when you look at the left side, yes, that it's true. Ad valorem tax increase, then money goes to the fiscus in the South, or for the South African government and for the South African country, but. So the red arrow, so that is for us the most important thing. So definitely then we will look at higher unemployment rates. We will reduce personal and corporate income taxes. We spoke about that. We will reduce our volume in sales and manufacturing in our business. We will definitely lose investor confidence. We will lose our skills development that we've worked on now for the last years, and brain drain. And so from my understanding, make it very short and simple, from my understanding, if we would have to accept these new APDP or ad valorem texts that will directly influence upcoming or product decisions for the future in the plant, and that will directly affect also the situation in the Eastern Cape. So last sentence from my side. So my proposal would be, please withdraw the current proposal from your side. And I spoke with a lot of people, so maybe it's necessary to create an executive committee or something like that that can work on these amendments of ad valorem tax and APDP. In conclusion, last sentence from my side. So if I don't know, so if I could have convinced you, but so I'm a production guy, I'm an engineer, and if you don't trust me, what I've talked about now, I invite you to the plant. So that is in East London. Give me a call. You have my email address. You can ask for my number, and I can show you that that I'm not talking about paperwork, that I'm not talking about slides. It's reality what you can see there in the plant and around the plant in the Eastern Cape and in East London. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Disband, South Africa, for the presentation. Let's now move to the National Association of Automobile Manufacturers of South Africa.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Mike Mabasa. I am the Chief Executive Officer of NAMSA, which is the National Association for Automobile Manufacturers of South Africa. I'm not alone, Chair. I've got a delegation that has accompanied me from some of our members. I've got my colleague, Mr. Andrew Pretorius, who sits with me at NAMSA. I've got my colleagues as well from BMW, who presented last week. I also have colleagues from Toyota SA, and also colleagues from Mercedes-Benz who have presented now, and also my colleagues from VW SA. So we have a very high power delegation that is here to talk to you today. So if I may, and perhaps maybe let me take the advantage that Mercedes-Benz has presented just before me and take you on a history lesson, a little bit, or a memory lane, if I may. South Africa imported its own and first vehicle in 1896. And that vehicle was called, it was actually ironically imported by Mercedes-Benz. And that car was called a Velo, a Benz Velo. That was in 1896. In 1897, the Velo burned down and it was destroyed by fire. If you look at what our local historians are saying to us, they're actually reaffirming that the incident of the burning of the Velo, actually that incident is the one that sparked the flame of passion for the automotive industry in South Africa. I can affirm, Chair, that our industry is built by visionaries, by entrepreneurs, by philanthropists, by people of extraordinary character. Those of us who are sitting here today are custodians of their intellectual property, their ideas, their philosophy, and the fruits of their audacity. We are also masters of our own destiny. I'm sure you are aware, Chair, that NAMSA represents more than 41 different companies who are either manufacturing vehicles here in South Africa and also those who are importing and distributing vehicles here in South Africa. And when I say vehicles, I speak under advisory because I'm talking not only about passenger vehicles and light commercial vehicles, but also, I'm also talking about buses, trucks, and what we call heavy commercial vehicles. Out of the all members of NAMSA, the 41 that have spoken, I can speak with authority, Chair, that we all agree that the proposed amendments, as proposed by National Treasury, are going to have huge implications for our industry as a whole. And I don't want to necessarily talk to the technical aspects of what the implications are. And I think those have been spoken to not only by Mercedes-Benz now in their own capacity, but certainly with other from other colleagues who presented before you last week. Chair, if I may, just very briefly, I think you may be aware that the automotive industry in South Africa contributes immensely to our economic lives as South Africa. We contribute currently around 7% towards the GDP of South Africa. If you look at our entire value chain, we also employ more than 110,000 people across the value chain. And also if you look at the multiplier effect of that employment, we actually employ more than 500,000 people in this country. We are convinced, Chair, that if these changes are made as currently proposed, they will certainly not serve the interests of South Africa. And we will certainly not be in a position to sustain the current momentum that we are trying to build as the industry. So let me remind you that it took South Africa 91 years from 1924 up until 2015 for us to be able to produce 600,000 vehicles annually in South Africa. 91 years. Last year, we came up with a master plan which suggests that we are going to increase our production capacity from the current levels of 600,000 to 1.4 million annually by 2035, which means effectively that we are going to produce double the amount of what we are currently producing within a period of 15 years. I'm sure many of you are asking yourselves, but if it took you guys 91 years to get to 600,000, what makes you think that it will take you 15 years to double that particular production capacity to 1.4 million? The answer is very simple, Chair. The answer lies in the fact that South Africa has developed very progressive legislation, very progressive incentive program, very progressive guidelines that assist us to be able to grow this industry even faster. Our ecosystem, Chair, is beginning to evolve, and we are very comfortable that if we are able to sustain the momentum that we are currently building upon, we will certainly be in a position to deliver the 1.4 million vehicles that we seek to deliver by 2035. We also want to double the employment of current people who are employed directly by the industry. I mentioned earlier on that we currently appoint or employ around 110,000 directly in our value chain. By 2035, we want to be able to get that number to more than 224,000. And we can only be able to do this if the legislative framework is fertile enough to be able to stimulate the growth that we really want to see in order for us to be able to get this industry to where it needs to be able to go to. Chair, I'm not going to remind us about our history as South Africa in terms of where we come from during the years of apartheid. I spoke about the 91 years that it took us to get to 600,000 vehicles. Largely and partly, the reason why that growth was sluggish was mainly also informed by the fact that we had laws that were very restrictive, we had government that did not care, and we had government that imposed legislations and guidelines that suffocated the industry. It is our considered view, Chair, that if we consider these amendments, we will be suffocating the industry, and we will certainly be retrogressing to levels where we are not able to grow the industry at the level at which we want to grow the industry. Thanks to our new democracy, Chair, since 1995, a year after we were liberated in this country, the automotive industry has exported more than 4.3 million cars out of South Africa. I mentioned earlier on that we currently produce 610,000 vehicles annually. 60% of those vehicles that we produce annually are actually destined for our export market. Those are not vehicles that are sold in South Africa, but vehicles that are destined for other markets beyond South Africa? Because currently we distribute vehicles to more than 155 different markets around the world. Since 1995, we've exported 4.3 million vehicles, and we were able to do this because of the MIDP and also the APDP, and now the APDP2 that we are now going to be venturing into, so that we can be able to make sure that we're able to continue to deliver on these ambitious targets that we have set for ourselves. Chair, we are equally excited as the industry because South Africa is a signatory of the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement. And we also have ratified that particular agreement as a country, which presents us with fantastic opportunities to can be able to continue and explore opportunities into the African continent, which is something that we have not done quite extensively in the past, because out of the 60% that I spoke about that we export into other markets, only 13% of that 60% goes into Africa. We want to be able to obviously increase that number quite extensively so that we can be able to make sure that we are able to reduce, amongst other things, the grain imports that are flooding our African continent at this particular moment. Chair, in conclusion, I want to reaffirm that on behalf of the automobile manufacturers of South Africa broadly, we cannot re-emphasize that the proposed amendments are certainly not progressive and certainly they are not necessary, particularly at this time when South Africa growth rate is at a very sluggish point. We need to be able to rally all of us as a country to be able to rejuvenate our economy so that we can be able to make sure that this economy can create more jobs, this economy can be able to grow, and we are able to make sure that we can be able to prosper as a nation. So NAMSA would want to propose, and I just want to punctuate what Andrea said earlier on, that our view, Chair, is that we need to go back to the drawing board, invite our colleagues from National Treasury, from the South African Revenue Service, from the Department of Trade and Industry, to partner with the industry in order for us to be able to jointly look at these proposals. And indeed, if these proposals are in the interest of the country going forward, we can all of us be able to find a formula that will be progressive and that will be able to take us to the next level. If we are going to just push the calculations and the new proposal just purely based on the fact that we want to generate additional revenue for the fiscus, it obviously will have unintended consequences for our economy. So for that reason, Chair, we want to echo what my colleagues from Mercedes-Benz have said earlier on, that the proposed amendments should be withdrawn at this time, so that we can be able to have enough time to can be able to re-engage quite very firmly on how we need to be able to take this particular matter forward. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mawasa from NAMSA. Questions from members? Questions from NAMSA and Honourable Dr. George.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks very much for your presentation. I agree that we don't want vehicle manufacturers to leave South Africa, especially given the current state of our economy, and I agree that the tax burden should not increase on the industry. I have been reading a bit ahead on the presentation that National Treasury is going to be giving us, and it does seem that the National Treasury has accepted arguments put by the industry regarding the impact, and they state that they want to mitigate the impact. So I'll wait to hear from the National Treasury on how they will achieve that. The industry has suggested a dialogue, and it certainly sounds that there is one, and I think that's a very good idea. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Church. Honourable Abrams.
Yes, Chair, I think we must appreciate the presentation as made, and I think they make a lot of sense in terms of the background, the impact, and so on. However, I thought the submission would be more specific in terms of what it is that is really bugging them. Because for me, Chair, this is exactly the platform that they should be using. It's a public hearing. It's an opportunity for them to say, in this and that area, we think we are being victimized, and therefore, for us, this is the way forward, instead of suggesting a later conversation, which, of course, can happen, but for now, they also have to make a submission, and for me, it's not very clear and not very specific as to what it is. I hear that they are complaining, however, the specifics are not that clear to me.
Thanks, Honorable Abrams. Honorable Scotland.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. No, we welcome the presentations from both the Mercedes-Benz and NAMSA. Just two questions, one for Mercedes-Benz. I think you are saying that your competition is internal. You've got the competition within the Mercedes-Benz itself. Can you just elaborate? Because I don't know how this industry works. What do you mean when you say your competition is more internally than externally? And then the question to NAMSA, you are saying you are producing 600,000 units annually, and then you said you are exporting, is it 60 units or 60%? 60% of the 600. Okay, so it means most of the units are exported. So we are selling. It means okay. You are selling only 40% locally. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks. Can we get the responses from Mercedes and NAMS?
I tried to explain it to you. So, looking at the current model we are producing in the East London plant, that is the C-Class model, and also the new product is the successor of the current C-Class, and that is the reason why we, for this successor model, invested 10 billion rand into the plant to extend the plant. This C-Class model is also produced in China, in Germany, in Hungary, and in South Africa. And we, when we have the discussion where we produce these cars, we have to calculate proper business cases for every location. And if the business case, for example, for South Africa is not competitive to Hungary, then it's today very easy to extend an Hungarian plant and produce the volume from South Africa and Hungary. So that is not really from an engineering perspective, a big topic. And that is why it's so important and why I said that. So we must be aware. So we, as a South African automotive industry, especially looking at Mercedes-Benz and BMW is in the same situation, we are producing our cars for the global markets, not for the South African market. And we are 10,000 kilometers far away from the market. Our market is not South Africa, our market is globally all over the world. And back to your question, so that is our internal competition for every plant. Every plant has to submit a proper business case. We have to apply for a new product, and if we are not competitive in South Africa, we will find from the company perspective, talking about Mercedes-Benz AG or Daimler AG, we will find other locations. That is what I'm saying.
Thank you very much. If I may, maybe to start also from where Andres left, South Africa is actually a case study because what Mercedes-Benz has explained is not necessarily peculiar only to Mercedes-Benz. BMW as well, they don't compete with Mercedes-Benz necessarily here in South Africa. They compete with another BMW in other markets. You'll recall here that we had General Motors in South Africa some less than 5 years ago. General Motors packed and left South Africa. And they took that production capacity to another market because one of the reasons why they left South Africa in this democracy was mainly because it was not competitive for them to produce the vehicles that they were producing in South Africa because they were not able to produce those vehicles cheaper in South Africa. So they looked at their entire footprint globally and they were convinced that the only way for them to continue producing the same vehicle was not in South Africa. And they moved that production to other markets in order for them to be able to continue producing the vehicles that they used to produce here. I just want to indicate here that in terms of the production, I mentioned the I just want to confirm that we produced 610,000 vehicles last year in 2018, and 60% of that 610,000, which is around 351,000 vehicles, went out of South Africa into 155 different countries. We only sold 42% of those vehicles in South Africa. And I also want to indicate here an important aspect that is important for the committee to note. But in South Africa, if you buy a car, a brand new car, 42% of what you pay into the retail price of that vehicle actually goes to tax. 42% goes into tax alone, which is a very big number. And in that basket of tax, you're looking at VAT, you're looking at ad valorem, you're looking at the tire levy, you're looking at different aspects within that basket that makes up 42%. And this is why our people in South Africa are not able to buy brand new cars, primarily because of the fact that our tax burden towards brand new vehicles is very, very high. So if I may, I'm going to allow Mr. Pretorius to respond to the question that was asked by Honourable Member at the beginning to say what are the actual specifics that we need to talk to, that we want to bring to the attention of the committee. With your indulgence, Chair, I'm going to request my colleagues to respond to that one.
Thank you, through the Chair. I'm Henry Pretorius, consultant at ANAMSA, and I've got 40-odd years' experience in the motor industry. My job is to consolidate the data of all the OEMs every quarter, so the quarterly duty account that's accurate. I can tell you that as an exact measurement in 2015, the impact of this change is 2 billion. So today it's about 2.5 billion on the industry, and it's a significant. It's earned by rebating, but it's used to maintain competitiveness, and each OEM uses it differently in their business models. This is hugely disruptive, this legislation change, and it has a significant effect on the ability of the OEMs in South Africa to be competitive. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Dispense and Namsa. Those are the responses to the questions by members. Let's move now to responses from National Treasurer and SARS on the submissions relating to the 2019 Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, 2019 Draft Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill, so 2019 Draft Rates and Monetary Amounts and Amendment of Revenue Laws Bill, and the 2019 Draft Income Tax Amendment Bill. We'll start, Mr. Momania.
Thank you, Chair. For giving us the opportunity to respond to all the comments that you've heard. Let me just say who the team is, if they can just introduce themselves, please. So my name is Usman Momolia, Tax and Financial Secretary in the Treasury.
Chris Axelson, Chief Director in the Economic Tax Unit in the National Treasury.
Yang Amfuta, Chief Director, Legal Tax Unit, National Treasury.
Ratoma Kaita, National Treasury, Business Taxes.
Morning, Chair. Morning, Honorable Members. I'm Ronel Musahayo from SARS, Legislative Research and Development.
So thank you, Chair. Chair, maybe just for members, since members are new, I just want to say a bit more in our opening, that if you look at the process for the taxes, and let me say today is a very rush process. Normally we have more time after receiving, so apologies, there's a bit of just-in-time production ourselves as well, because I think we do need more than a week. This is record time for producing it, but that's fine. We have to adjust when you have an election and parliament and, you know, everything is slowed down or comes later. But, Chair, so just to remind members, what we've done so far is that we've had all these four bills. If you look at the first point, they were published for public comment. Bear in mind, the announcement was done in February. Before the election. So it's that budget we're still talking about. But we have some consultations because the point about tax policy is that there's a bit of shock and awe, I say, sometimes, because we can't consult before we impose a tax or make changes to a tax. But hopefully we get it right by when we actually publish the tax bill, and that's when every person could read the tax laws and see how it's going to affect them. It's hard to do that just from the February announcement. But because, again, you know, it's quite possible we get things wrong because there's no prior consultation by definition. So we then start the process of public comments on the bills themselves, and hence we've had the submissions, for example, from NAMSA, Mercedes-Benz, and so on. And I want to just assure everyone, we definitely hear what people have to say. We don't go with tax policy and say, we've got it right, and you can say what you like, that's the law, okay? And we're not going to change. It's not a false consultation process. We're quite concerned to see what the impact is, and we can only hear the impact when a company or a person tax directly comes. Sometimes not even the association would know, obviously, exactly how it might impact on each of their members. And we certainly, I think, are concerned about investment in South Africa. So thank you from all the various industries for coming forward and providing their inputs and letting us know of the potential consequences. We also have to be aware, though, that sometimes there's a bit of exaggeration for effect, perhaps. And it's very hard to figure out, is this a real threat, or are people just making a noise because they don't want to pay a higher tax? So it's hard. We do have to need a bit of wisdom of Solomon on this. On these issues, okay, because we also do need revenue to the state, and certainly we need to spend that well as well. So those are important. But I do want to make a point. There is a lot of abuse, especially when there are tax incentives, and sometimes they go to the wrong areas. So we think it's going for jobs promotion, but it might be towards property speculation. That doesn't really add value. So those are the kinds of issues that we have to deal with. what you have today, Chair, and I just want to make one final point. Tax policy is independent of all other processes. So whatever agreements there may be with industry and whichever other part of government, I just want to make the point, because we've been approached to say, how can you increase the taxes, this agreement or that agreement? And I say, please know the way South Africa works, and any government works, is that your tax policy can change. In theory, even your corporate income tax can be increased. Okay? Now, economically, it doesn't make sense to do it. Investors won't be happy, and a country doing so risks having a very, very bad outcome if it's reckless with how tax policy is done. And that's why generally, on the major taxes, the path has always been downwards. We prefer to give a positive surprise, and for 15 years or so now, democracy generally, or 20 years, we've been generally bringing tax rates down, but times have become tough since 2015, 2016. But, and so you've had personal tax been increased on one or two occasions, and VAT been increased, and so we're not very popular when it comes to tax policy in these tough times. And even though we are aware that when you increase tax as the economy is shrinking, it's also not necessarily good for growth. Okay, so one's got to watch all of those things, and that's why I say one needs a lot of wisdom of Solomon here. But we've increased, for example, the carbon, we've introduced the carbon tax. There are taxes that for good reason are imposed, the sugary beverage one as well, for either revenue or other reasons. But I think the point needs to be made that tax policy, no state can give up its right to tax. Otherwise, you don't have a state. And those decisions are taken. But having said that, I want to assure everyone that once the proposal is there, we do want to have deep consultative processes. And to the extent that we can deal with concerns that we think are legitimate, we will deal with them. And that's the spirit of today. So, Chair, just to go on. So we've had all the presentations, to go back, we've had the presentations. What we've produced today is a mammoth slide presentation to help them. There's also a document that we have, which Yanga wants to show you, which is the actual response. So what we do, Chair, is we try and take all the proposals that have come through. We don't say this is from Mercedes-Benz, or this is from NAMSA, or this is from this company. We try and say, what's the issue? Because there's often common issues, and list all the issues and all the proposals made. And we try and write up our response so that we're quite transparent and to say we've accepted the proposal, we've not accepted it, or it's partially accepted. That's how we respond. Now, bear in mind, in terms of the tax process, these are draft bills. And so if Parliament's broadly today happy with this approach, or the committee is happy, we then go back and go to the minister. The minister's not approved these changes as yet. The minister comes in and prefers to wait for the comments, to wait to get a draft response to see how Parliament would like to make amendments to the draft bills. And that forms the basis of the minister. Then you can get to the next slide. So what happens is the minister then agrees to the final set of changes, and these are changed in the bill. And that bill is normally introduced then towards the end of October. It normally coincides with the MTBPS. It's not really linked to the MTBPS because the MTBPS is forward-looking. This is, but normally the minister tables them on that day. Thereafter, again, the standing committee will then formally have the bill and has to consider the bill and approve it. And normally that's a quick process, and the National Assembly will try and pass the bills around mid-November, end November. But the problem we face is that we do need the bills passed by before Parliament rises. Well, I think I should use the word prorogue, okay? Then what you have is that the select committee in the NCOP has to formally consider the bills for approval, and thereafter the NCOP, and normally this goes right up to the last day of Parliament in the year, and then gets to the President over December, and over December, January, it gets signed into law. It's very important that for various reasons, not that it's absolutely necessary in every case, that the laws are in place by end December or early January at the latest, and well before February 28th, which is the normal tax year for individuals. So that's the constraint we have. Move on. So Chair, what you've got today, I'm going to ask the team, and all different people will come in. So we will go through the slide on all of the issues. What I'll ask the team to do is, if it's not been contested or presented, let's just flash the slide, talk very quickly, okay? But let's spend more time on the issues that have been raised. If members want to stop us here, that's fine. We can then explain more if they need that. And bear in mind, it's then backed up by this draft document that Yanga showed. So without further ado, we'll just go through each of the proposals and for your consideration. Who's starting? Yanga or Chris?
Thank you, Chair. Just on the first one, we had quite a few comments on the rates for changes to the increase in the excise duties on tobacco. There were some comments that said if we keep increasing the excise duties on tobacco, it'll lead to a much larger illegal market. Tobacco farmers.
Before you please.
Thank you.
I'm not sure. I was not a member of this committee before. You distribute copies to stakeholders or they rely on overhead in a PowerPoint presentation?
We may not have physical copies, but all of these documents are made public. So we do give everybody copies here. Hopefully they have it, but it will definitely be on our website.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. The first one on illicit tobacco, that we shouldn't increase excise duty rates on tobacco because of the impact on the illegal market and the impact on tobacco farmers. Our initial response is we don't accept that line of argument. We don't think that the excise duty increases are the sole reason for the growth in illicit trade. It is followed a stable policy environment where we target 40% of the most popular brand of cigarettes. It has gone slightly above that targeted incidence in the last few years. So we really have been working with SARS to try and improve enforcement. I think SARS were here and spoke to the committee yesterday, and the commissioner did mention the work that they're doing to beef up their illicit economy unit within SARS and the work against illicit economy, and tobacco is part of that. The other one was on there should be the same treatment of between tobacco and pipe tobacco and other products, and it looks as if pipe tobacco is being taxed at a lower rate. The policy in this point is that it should still be 40% of the most popular brand, but within each category. So it's 40% of the pipe tobacco, the most popular pipe tobacco brand. So we do think we have consistency in the treatment there. There was also a request to hold the excise duty rate for the next 3 years. As before, we have got quite a stable policy environment of looking at the targeted tax incidence. It is also up to the Minister of Finance each year. We've got this targeted incidence that we put forward, but there is the discretion available to the Minister of Finance to go up or down, and we don't want to say what the Minister of Finance will or will not do at the next budget. There is also a comment on other types of tobacco products that are coming in that are potentially less harmful. This refers to, say, vaping or tobacco heating products. And these should be taxed, but they should be taxed based on the harm that they cause. This is something that we've already said we are looking into. In the budget earlier this year, we said we intended to start taxing products such as tobacco heating products and potentially vaping. We need to work very closely with the National Department of Health on this, and they've already started the process of amending their current tobacco legislation. So we are underway. It has been interesting that in the U.S. They've been a lot stronger on vaping, especially flavored vaping products of late. Then goes on to carbon tax amendments in the 2019 draft income tax amendment bill. The one was on the repeal of the tax exemption for the certified emission reductions. So currently, if you have a project that's developed under what's called the Clean Development Mechanism from the Kyoto Protocol to reduce your carbon emissions, if you then sold that project and you got income from it, it was exempt in the Income Tax Act as a way to incentivize these projects going forward. The proposal was to remove this exemption because from the introduction of the carbon tax on 1 June 2019, now those projects would be eligible for what we would call carbon offset projects. So the same project can now then be used to be sold to companies who have a carbon tax liability, and in effect they can get the benefit that way. So we didn't want what we normally call double dipping in this instance. The comment suggested, well, they recognize that there might be double dipping, but can this not continue and you just change the legislation so that it's only used one or the other? In our view, we'd still like to remove the exemption. The carbon offset projects will be the main mechanism through which reductions in greenhouse gas emissions can now be used and incentivized in the new environment. It also would create some distortions where we're giving this exemption for the clean development mechanism, but we're not giving it for what's called the gold standard or the verified carbon standard, the VCS regime, where you can also use those regimes under the carbon offset. So because of those reasons, we'd like to keep the repeal. The next one was on the energy efficiency savings tax incentive. This was meant to come to an end this year, and we've extended this efficiency savings tax incentive for the first phase of the carbon tax. There was just broad support by stakeholders for this extension of the incentive, and they've actually asked for a third for it to extend past phase one of the carbon tax, to extend the incentive past 2022. It's noted we're looking at it, but the current position is to keep it for this first phase. And there were also some technical amendments, and we got some comments on that, on meeting thresholds and being above thresholds. They said that we must align with DES, so we are trying to align with the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries as far as possible in terms of their requirements for greenhouse gas emissions. There was also comment on we've made some changes to how you calculate your exact greenhouse gas emissions, and there were comments that say you shouldn't put this in the Income Tax Act, but we'd like to try and be as explicit as we can to keep it within the Income Tax Act to show taxpayers the different methodologies that they can use to calculate their greenhouse gas emissions. There was also a comment about from industry, which was a very useful comment, to show that the greenhouse gas emissions that they're going to report to the Department of Environmental, Forestry and Fisheries might not be the same one that is required for the Carbon Tax Act. So now that could be a problem because SARS does need to see the exact value from DEF, but now there might be a situation where they're not the exact same values. So we have got a proposal to try and sort this out, to use a range in Schedule 1 of the Carbon Tax Act so that the taxpayers can use the correct methodology, and then if it is slightly different from DEF within that specific subcategory, then they provide documentation justifying why they are using a different reason. We still need to consult with SARS on this and make sure we get it right, but we do need to get that DEF reporting and SARS reporting correct, and it is a very useful comment.
On the 2019 draft TLEP, I think, as Momo has said, we're going to flesh out the bigger issues that were raised in Parliament. I think the most important issue was the tax treatment of surviving spouse, whereby the members had interest in it. What is happening is that if a surviving spouse is receiving a monthly spousal pension and also maybe working, receiving employment income, at the end of the tax year, when those salaries are aggregated, they push the surviving spouse's income to the next level and then taxed at a higher bracket. So we understand that at the end of the tax last year, the surviving spouse is marched to National Treasury in this regard. And in order to cater for this, because we are a listening government, amendments were made in the 2019 TLEP to cater only for the surviving spouses. So during public consultation, it came to our attention that not only surviving spouses that are receiving monthly spousal pension and employment income get into this position, even other individuals that have got two sources of employment income, at the end of the tax year, they are pushed to another bracket. So in order to look at this, we are proposing that we make it wider for all the individuals that have got two sources of employment income, but because there are administrative changes in the system that needs to be made by both staff, taxpayers, and maybe those employers, we propose to change the effective date and postpone it by a year from 1 March 2020 to 1 March 2021. I don't know if the members will just pass through the slides and then we'll raise the important issues. I just want to move from the chair.
What's the take of members? If you want to ask questions in between, they give a full presentation, then you have the questions later. Honorable Abrams.
Yes, we won't ask questions now, Chair, until the end, but I think rather than just passing through a slide, just a comment and then, you know, in detail on the ones that are critical for.
Okay. We'll go back to the return. Thank you. Back. Okay.
Thank you, members. There was also just a small point on we are trying to allow for a case where there were funds within a retirement fund that was allocated to members from there were previous cases where I think it was called secret profits, and these were supposed to be allocated to members. At the moment, there's no way for the Income Tax Act to give this amount to members tax-free, even though it was from retirement. We're creating a provision to allow this for a one-off period, and there was a small change on the wording about to show that the administrator doesn't own those funds. But we don't think it needs to be changed. If it's held by under control, it doesn't apply ownership. I'll just talk about the exemption relating to annuities from provident funds or provident preservation funds. So this is saying that in the current legislation, we are saying that if there was one third of the amount was taken from a provident fund or provident preservation fund, that amount can be tax-free when they receive it in retirement. I'm just checking I'm on the right one. The comments were saying that this can be for everybody. It doesn't need to be how much they take, as long as it was taxed previously, you shouldn't tax it again to avoid double taxation. So we've agreed with that, and we've gotten rid of the one-third, two-thirds requirements. They did want the effective date to be earlier, but it does need system changes, so we are still going to stick with the effective date of 1 March 2020. The other one was a new policy proposal, just to say that can individuals receive the first $500,000 they receive in an annuity tax-free? This is a new policy proposal. It's not part of the legislation, so we haven't made any changes here. There was another change on the tax-neutral transfers between funds. So in a pension fund, when you retire, you can only take one third of the lump sum. In a provident fund, when you retire, you can take the full amount as a lump sum. For that reason, because of the difference, we don't allow tax-free transfers from a pension to a provident, because then everyone would move across to the provident and take everything out that they would like to take out. We made a small oversight in the previous legislative cycle because of all the delays in provident fund annuitization, which then allowed tax-neutral transfers between the two funds. This was never the policy intent. Taxpayers are saying, well, it was a mistake in the legislation, so we should allow it. But this really was just a technical amendment. It wasn't part of the policy, so we have made that adjustment and corrected for those transfers now. You can look at the slide. I think it's slide 25 we're on now. Okay. Slide 24. Okay. The next one is on avoiding estate duty. So, screen's not working, but if people have slide presentations, they can look at slide 24. It's on measures aimed at avoiding estate duty. So this comes from a Davis Tax Committee proposal that was done a number of years ago, where there was a loophole where you could just, if you were on, I don't know how to say it, likely deathbed, and then you contribute a huge amount to your retirement annuity fund, in effect you could then get around estate duty. So we changed the law to say that if you made that very large contribution above the limits, it would now be included in estate duty. We were tightening up those responses, how that worked in the legislation. However, we deleted a part which said that it didn't take into account the amount you receive in the form of an annuity before you die. So we did that, and we accept the comments there that we didn't mean to delete that section as well. So now if you take amounts before you die as part of the annuity, that will reduce the amount that will then go into your estate for estate duty purposes. So we've accepted that. Variable remuneration?
The next one was an administrative change trying to assist most low-income employees, because what happens is that in terms of the employment tax, you have to match the income when it accrues and when it is actually paid. So what happens is that it came to our attention that someone will work as a night shift or get a shift allowance in this year, and then the next year starts before the amount is paid, and then that was disrupting the system. So we're trying to match the timing of payment and accrual. So what we were told is that because the current provisions in the Act are specific, we've got like what is regarded, like we've got natures of income, and then you have to be generic, not specific. So we tried in the TLAB to be generic, and then they said our proposal makes it administratively burdensome, but we must go back to the specific. So what we're going to do in the specific list, we're going to add more amounts that are taken into account in terms of 66 subsection. But meaning that because now it's a specific list, and that's what we're trying to avoid, we're going to keep on making amendments based on the comments received. And the next one is income tax, business tax general, and anti-avoidance issues. Okay, it should be slide 27 on the handout. So we'll start with the anti-dividend stripping provisions. So we got numerous comments in this regard. We've been on this journey with these rules since 2017. The overriding comment was the change that we've made through the years since 2017 in our policy focus with these rules and how they apply widely. So we are of the view that these rules, before the changes that came about in 2017, were so specific. They were so limited in the application, it was very easy to avoid them. You had links between a dividend that a taxpayer or a shareholder could use to extract value and a subscription price that the new entrant or the new shareholder would pay for new shares. And you'd have instances of actual disposal thereafter. So what necessitated these current rules was that after those the introduction of those 2017 rules, which broadened the scope of the rules, you had instances where these rules were then being avoided using new structures where they would issue shares to introduce a new shareholder after or within 18 months of an extraordinary dividend and then not dispose thereby avoiding the rules. So we now have an issue where they say we've moved in the policy direction. There should be that linkage between the entry of the new shareholder and the exit of the old shareholder using the dividend. We cannot go back there because we've experienced what that linkage does. It makes it very easy to avoid. It makes it. It also makes it. Makes the rules completely unworkable from our point of view. But that being said, we are making some changes to the current proposal in order in a way to limit and clarify the application. One of the issues that we will be clarifying is the concept of the effective interest of the old shareholder after the issuance of shares. In that regard, it must be noted, though, that we are still concerned about the potential for use of different classes of shares to further avoid the application of the rules even after this legislative cycle. So what we will do there is clarify how what we consider that to be the manner in which we expect shareholders to work out the effective interest, having a look at which scenarios using different classes of shares pose the least risk to the fiscus, and then carving those out, for example, your funding type shares, your funding preference shares. So those are the concessions we are making in that regard. The second one that we'll be making is with regards to the comment that there is no parity between the 2017 rules, which when disposal is triggered, you have the benefit of applying your base cost, basically your original cost of acquisition of the shares against the extraordinary dividend, thereby limiting your exposure when the rules are triggered, between the 2019 proposed rules where you do not get a base cost because it's a deemed disposal for purpose of these rules. So in that regard, we're saying we're holding fast to that position because this anti-avoidance measure is meant to curb scenarios where you are avoiding the taxes that you would normally experience when you dispose of your share, right, by extracting value through the exempt dividends. But what we are doing is that should these provisions apply and trigger a tax liability for you, in the instance that subsequently you dispose, you will be able to have access to that historical base cost for those shares. So you will be able to mitigate your liabilities because of the capital loss that you'll be able to claim. Lastly, the issue that we'll be looking at is how the rules interact with corporate reorganization rules. Particularly at issue would be the type of unbundling transactions or other transactions where in of themselves those transactions are extraordinary dividends. So we're going to go back in the rules and look at those and clarify the interaction because we don't want a situation where we have these rules apply to instances where deferral would normally have applied and undermining those deferral rules. Okay, so those are in broad terms. Those are the three limitations that we're going to apply to our current rules. Yes. Okay. I'll continue. for discussion is, are there anti value shift rules? These are the rules in the, contained in the Act, which basically help us ensure that where taxpayers dispose of the asset in exchange for the issuance of shares to company, from the company that they're disposing of the asset to, that those assets and the shares you get back are of comparable value. So in effect, you don't give away high value assets for very low value shares. So what we were doing in the proposed rules was that we were clarifying instances where after you do your asset for share exchange and have to look at whether there is a difference in value and that you're basically not value shifting, should there be a differential between the value of your asset and the share because of deferred tax basically resulting from accounting reporting, you need to disregard those differences and don't need to trigger the rules. So that's what we did in the rules, but during the discussions in the workshops in September, 5th and 6th of September, we then started debating with the participants there about, well, how do we then refer to this deferred tax asset or liability? Do we refer to IFRS? Which accounting standard do we refer to? So it came to light that everybody is using, particularly in SMEs, they're using different accounting standards. In some instances, they don't reflect those deferred tax consequences in their reporting. And in essence, what we got from those engagements from taxpayers is that it's clearly understood in the in industry that these rules are meant to curb value shifting instances and not look at mere differences because of a reporting standard. So it's not particularly necessary to have these rules. So hence, this proposal will be withdrawn, given that we've gotten some surety that they actually do not need it because this was their initial request in any case. When we move on to amendments in relation to special interest deductions granted for debt used to fund controlling interest in shares of highly productive companies, so operating companies which have operating assets and give rise to income. Here we had two issues that we were dealing with. The first one was of a technical nature where we were dealing with rules with regards to startups, and I think that was accepted. So that was accepted across the board, so it's not necessary for discussion here. The other issue is the one that's appearing on the slide where we had wanted to enable taxpayers to continue to basically have access to the special interest deduction should they have in the original transaction acquired an indirect holding in an operating company and then subsequently acquired a direct interest in an operating company after an unbundling transaction. There were two issues there. I can quickly just go through them. Is that in the first instance, it was the issue that why don't we allow the same continuation if you go from an indirect holding to another indirect holding of an operating company? And the question is, why would we allow that type of continuation without having to do a redetermination? Because we're only making this concession because we feel if you're going from an indirect holding to a direct holding, we are now moving closer to the asset base that produces income. The other issue was that, fine, if you focus on allowing the continuation without the necessity for a redetermination, if you go from an indirect shareholding to a direct shareholding, why limit it only to unbundling transactions? In that regard, liquidation transactions which result with a taxpayer's holding a direct interest in a productive operating company will be looked at.
The next one, remember last time, I said it's more of an accounting provision rather than legal. I defer to the accountant.
Thank you, Yanga. Honorable Chair, honorable members, the current slide deals with the interaction between corporate reorganization rules and special rules dealing with exchange items and interest-bearing instruments. These are the rules that we briefly explained in the initial briefing. So currently the income tax contains corporate reorganization rules that provide for a tax neutral transfer of assets between group companies. However, these rules do not specifically provide for or address how exchange items and interest-bearing instruments should be treated during corporate restructuring. For instance, it's unclear whether the corporate reorganization rules override the specific rules in Section 24J and 24I. So the current proposal is to clarify the policy position that corporate reorganization rules override the specific rules in 24J and 24I. So the main comment that we receive from taxpayers is that it is unclear why these specific rules for interest-bearing instruments and exchange items are being excluded as they are no different from other assets. So our response is that the interest-bearing instruments and exchange items are different from other assets because they are mainly influenced by currency fluctuations and interest rates. I think that is all, and to just say as well that currently we check these exchange items and interest-bearing instruments on unrealized basis in any case. Thank you.
And then to wrap up the issues around intergroup companies, intergroup transactions and rollover rules, there was a proposal in the 2019 NHSC with regards to re-looking at the interaction of the anti-avoidance provisions that are applicable to intergroup transactions. So these intergroup transactions are transactions that allow taxpayers to enter into asset transfer arrangements among group companies where the taxes are deferred at that moment. So because it's a tax deferral, it's a tax benefit that is being conferred to taxpayers, there are the various anti-avoidance rules in the Act so that these rules don't get abused. So we had taken it upon ourselves that we're going to look at the interaction of these anti-avoidance rules to make sure that should one rule apply and maybe subsequently another rule apply, they don't give rise to a potential of double taxation or some warped results where you're basically clawing back the same sort of amount. But when we were having discussions in the drafting of the proposals in the draft TLAB, the rules that we focused on was the degrouping rules, in essence where if you enter into this tax deferred transaction and within 6 months those two entities that had entered into the transactions no longer form a group of companies, there's a rule that basically claws back or reverses that tax deferral and then tax is levied on that reversal. But in that instance, we felt that it was more of an interpretation that should you then have a degrouping and then afterwards have a deemed grouping, degrouping, you wouldn't want to then reverse what has already been reversed. So we thought those then changes were not necessary. But through workshop engagement, there was another issue raised with regards to the interaction, and that relates to when assets are transferred between group companies on loan account and the rule with regards to the base cost of that loan receivable is deemed to be zero. So the interaction of that rule and the degrouping provisions would be looked at to clarify, because once a degrouping happens, it means that you no longer have deferral, your benefit has been reversed, it shouldn't, it's no longer necessary that other avoidance rules then still remain in place. So that will be looked at and clarified.
Thank you, Chair. We go to the next one, income tax, business and financial institutions. As the parliament member said, I normally gloss over. So the next one is clarifying inconsistencies in the tax regime, REIT tax regime. Currently, we get tax incentives for REITs that are only listed, real estate investment trusts. So it came to our attention that in order for them to expand their portfolio, they have to go offshore and buy properties offshore to invest offshore. At issue was that the issue, the exchange, the foreign exchange gains were not included in the definition of rental income. Thereby, it makes them to fail the rental income test and the qualifying distribution test. So in order to assist them in this regard, we made changes in the 2019 draft TLAB, which were also announced in the budget, to say that we're going to only assist them only foreign exchange gains related to rental income. So their comment was that we must extend the proposal to all the foreign exchange incurred by a REIT in its activities. And our view, we said, no, here we are trying to assist you, and the budget proposal was limited to rental income. So we're not going to accept that comment, that proposal. We're going to limit it to the rental income. The next big one also is the taxation of long-term insurers. In the 2019 TLAB, we included a provision whereby the long-term insurers asked us to say that if a risk policy, currently if a risk policy pays an annuity, is taken from the definition of risk policy and goes to untaxed policy fund. So they came to us and say that that is administratively burdensome. We must change the law to allow for the risk policy to remain a risk policy. So we did make changes in the 2019 draft TLAB. Come the public consultation workshop, they came to us and say that, no, we want to make an election so that insurers must choose to use the proposed changes or not to use the proposed changes. So we must give them an election instead of the legislation blanketly applying to them whenever they are paying a risk policy fund in terms of an annuity. Our view is that if we're going to make an amendment in the bill that gives taxpayers election, it's going to be administratively burdensome for SARS to look at each and every taxpayer and see whether have you elected to do this, have you elected not to do this. During the workshop, most insurers said, no, they are affected, but now there was one insurer that says it's affected. So what we are proposing is that in order for us not to have a provision that is mandatory applying to all the insurers, because maybe there's only one insurer that is affected, and we do not want to make a legislation that is, has got an election, we are proposing to withdraw this provision from the proposal. And then the next one is business tax incentives. Those are the biggest ones. The first one is the refining the special economic zone incentive regime. Currently, we've got an SEZ regime whereby those qualifying companies that are located within the SEZ regime, and deeming an SEZ regime requires two government departments, DTI and National Treasury, to deem an area as an SEZ. So when you are operating within the SEZ, you get a 15% tax rate instead of 28% tax rate, which is applicable to companies. When we were doing our public consultation workshops last year, it came to our attention, taxpayers told us that the current tax legislation does not have limitations enough, in so much that companies may relocate from non-SEZ to the SEZ without adding any new investment or anything. So because we were told that our tax legislation has got a loophole, we do not have a new investment requirement, we do not have an expansion of existing business requirement. Because taxpayers told us that this is a loophole, we made changes in the 2019 draft TLEP so as to close the loophole by putting a new investment test for the companies that are new in the SEZ. And then if you are relocating or already in the SEZ, you must have, there's already also an expansion test. You must show that you've expanded your businesses. And the reason why we require these things, because you get an incentive of being taxed at 15% instead of taxed at the current tax rate of 28%. During the public consultation process, we were told that our tests are too stringent, in that we are too stringent in our tests, and then it will be difficult to meet the new investment test and also the expansion test. So in order to minimize these tests, we're going to make legislative changes in the TLEP so as to take away the issue of expansion, because they said, how are you going to measure expansion? Because you are Treasury and you are SARS and not CCI. So there we're going to put a new jobs requirement. And the reason why there's a new jobs requirement is that companies that are already in the SEZ, they also claim the ETI incentive. So we thought that to have a requirement to have new jobs as a test, it will be easier for SARS to look at. The next one was an anti-avoidance measure. I think during the initial briefings, we went into extent explaining the issue that currently, when you are within the SEZ, there are businesses you are not allowed to sell to your connected business, which is outside the SEZ, because that is merely shifting profits from one company to your connected person. However, it is okay if you are operating within the SEZ to sell to unconnected persons outside the SEZ. And the reason why we had the connected person test was that the main aim of SEZ was mainly for export. So now, if you are just selling from one company in the SEZ to your subsidiary outside SEZ, meaning that you are shifting profits from a low tax zone to a high tax zone. So we thought that that is not fair. So what happened is that we have currently a test to say that if you are shifting profits and if you are shifting about if more than 20% of your profits you are selling to your connected person, then you're not going to get the 15% tax rate. So the taxpayers came to us to say that our test for anti-avoidance measure, which is an all-or-nothing approach, is too cumbersome and limiting. So in the 2019 draft TLEP, we tried to make a point, to make changes to say that, okay, we're not going to do an all-or-nothing approach, but you taxpayers, and if you are selling 20%, then the 20% will qualify for 15% tax rate. But if you are selling more than 20%, it will be on the 28% side. And then they said that test is too cumbersome because it will make them to keep two books, it will be difficult to administer, and now we are imposing two tax rates to the SEZ regime. And then they said that in order for us not to make this proposal, they come with a further proposal to say that SARS must have a domestic transfer pricing on the SEZ. So our view is that for SARS to conduct domestic transfer pricing on SEZ, it will need more capacity on SARS, because currently SARS is doing transfer pricing on offshore, and it will need more changes in the legislation, because Section 31 dealing with transfer pricing in our legislation deal with transfer pricing based on offshore sale of goods, not on onshore sale of goods. So our view was that we're going to withdraw the proposal in the 2019 draft TLEP. But SARS has to make investigation, and SARS will have to tell us if they have capacity to do domestic transfer pricing. And if SARS tells us that they have capacity to do domestic transfer pricing, changes to the tax legislation will be made in the 2020 legislative cycle. The next big one, which parliamentarians was during public hearings, was the venture capital company tax incentive regime. We said in the 2019 budget review, currently when a shareholder invests in a VCC, there is no limit. whatever amount you invest in a VCC, you qualify for an upfront deduction. You invest 100 million, you qualify for an upfront deduction. You invest 5 million, you qualify for an upfront deduction. So what we did in the 2019 draft TILAB was that say no, because what we have seen is that ultra high net worth individuals and family companies, they make big investments before the tax year ends so as to reduce their taxable income. And because of this, this is undermining the progressivity of our tax system because you pay as you earn. The more you have income, the more tax rate you pay. So what we did in the 2019 draft TILAB is that we said, no, we're going to introduce a cap. So the only amount that you can be allowed as an upfront deduction will be 2.5 million. So if you invest more than 2.5 million, that amount is not going to be allowed as an upfront deduction. Only 2.5 million that can be allowed as an upfront deduction. During the workshops and also during the public hearings that were held last week in Parliament, of which I think that's what Momo was saying, we found that most businesses are investing in hotels. And we asked, like, because the issue of the VCC was meant to give money, qualifying companies were meant to be SMEs, those SMEs that it's difficult to get funding. So, and based on the public hearings, they said that, okay, maybe you should introduce two different caps for individuals and a separate cap for companies, individuals, natural persons and trusts, and a separate cap for companies. And then we listened. And then in the draft TILAB, we are proposing a cap, but our cap remains as follows. For natural persons and trust, it's only 2.5 million, and for corporate investors, it will be 5 million. That is what we are proposing. And then the next one, whereby we're saying that an issue is that currently, the current VCC structure should not be impacted by the changes that we made in the 2019. And we said, in order for the legislation to be fair and to mitigate non-compliance, we have to do grandfathering provisions because when you change the legislation in July, there are other investors who have already invested in the VCC and we do not want to impact on their non-compliance.
Chair, I want to add and just make it clear. We are quite concerned with the tax abuse. We know there's a lobby out there, there's a tax incentive. A lot of this is not going towards the development of small businesses. We will continue to monitor and refine it because it's going towards property speculation and, like Yana says, hotels in Santon, Mshlanga. These are not hotels in, you know, further areas and so on. So I think that we will continue to monitor these because the abuse, we believe, is way out of proportion and, as Yanga says, undermines the progressivity of the tax system.
And then the next one here, we are aligning the employment tax incentive with the national minimum wage. And changes were made in the national minimum wage last year, and our employment tax incentive must keep up with other government policies. So what we are doing here, we are aligning the national employment minimum wage with the ETI tax incentives that may be claimable. Okay, the last one also that was discussed during the hearing was the issue of the public benefit organization. Currently, in the Income Tax Act, we have a transitional measure when we introduce the new PBO legislation to say that PBOs have up to 2010 and 2004 to reapply for the public benefit organization status so that they can qualify for the tax exempt status. Because these provisions were meant for to be transitional, and the issue was that now it came to our attention that some PBOs who have got know-how, who were submitting tax returns, we are not talking about those PBOs who did not even know that they are taxable, who are not even submitting the tax returns. They will come to us maybe after 5 or 10 years, which is beyond the years of prescription of 3 years, and then claim a refund, apply for a PBO status, and then claim a refund, and this SARS is giving them refund, they have to also give them interest, dating back beyond the years that they have prescribed. So in order to curb this, we in the 2019 TLEB, we repealed those provisions because we said that those provisions were meant to be transitional. During public hearings, we were told that they asked if we repeal this provision, it will impact on the smaller PBOs, that they were not aware that they can qualify for tax-exempt status. So what we're going to do in the draft TLEB is to modify the rules, not to repeal them, but now we're going to give it to the commissioner's discretion whether to give you a retrospective approval or not. And we're going to the international tax now, so we're moving fast. On the international tax side, the first amendment was the comparable tax exemption. As you have said, that you've got the controlled foreign company legislation, whereby if a South African resident owns more than 50% of the foreign-owned, the income of the foreign-owned company is taxable in the hands of South African tax residents, as if the income was earned in South Africa. And you have to apply the South African tax system to do that. So in so when we were doing this legislation in 2001, we were told that in order for the South African companies to be competitive, because you may be a South African company, you may be a South African resident having an offshore company maybe in the UK, and UK is a high-tax country. We are not talking about low-tax, we are not talking about low-tax countries. So we were told that in order for the South African companies to be competitive offshore, we must give them an exemption. And then we have something called comparable tax exemption, whereby if you pay tax of about 75% of the South African tax, and then you won't be taxable in South Africa, you won't include that income into the South African tax debt. So as Mama is saying, that all over the world, countries are lowering their corporate income tax rate. And most especially, UK has lowered their corporate tax rate to about 19% and is still going down to 17%. And most of our South African resident companies, most of our controlled companies are mostly in the UK. So in order to be competitive, we are reducing the comparable tax exemption from 75% to 67.5%. During the workshop, they were saying that it's not enough. So we are saying that because this is a rate change, if maybe our trading partners in the next year, they do lower their corporate income tax rate, a study and an assessment will be done. An announcement will be made in the budget to say that we have to review the comparable tax exemption. So this review can be done yearly. The next one is reviewing the definition of affected transaction in the definition of arm's length transfer pricing rules. As you know, that we've got transfer pricing rules that look at mispricing of sale of goods to offshore. So currently, we've got currently the test in the transfer pricing is the connected person test. You only apply transfer pricing rules when you sell goods to an offshore connected person. And it has come to our attention that the current test in the transfer pricing rules, which it refers to connected person, is not enough, because there are structures whereby they are not connected person, but they are associated. So we are making amendments now in the definition to have a test of the term associated enterprise instead of a connected person test. And the associated enterprise test is also available both in the UN and the OECD Model Tax Convention. So during the workshop, we were told that the term associated enterprise is far-reaching, it needs interpretation. And then we said that, okay, we're not going to repeal this amendment. What we're going to do, we're going to postpone the effective date to 2021, and SARS is going to come up with an interpretation note of what is the meaning of associated enterprise in this regard. And the last one is the reviewing the definition of permanent establishment. Currently, in the Income Tax Act, we've got a definition of permanent establishment, which is more, there's a South African definition of permanent establishment in Section 1, And also there is a treaty definition of permanent establishment, which is also the definition that we take in the multilateral instrument that we signed as South Africa for base erosion and profit shifting. So in the 2019 draft TLEF, what we tried to do was to say that we're going to align the definition of permanent establishment in Section 1, that is the domestic definition, with the text treaties and the position taken by South Africa in the MLI. During the public workshops, we were told that aligning the domestic definition is going to be limiting because the definition taken in the MLI and text treaties is too narrow, and yet the current one in Section 1 of the Income Tax Act is too wide. So it's better to have a wider definition in the Income Tax Act than to have a limited one. And it can be only limited in the bilateral tax treaties. So in the now we are proposing to withdraw the proposed amendment in the TLEF. The last one on the value added tax, this one is a small one. It's bad treatment of foreign donor-funded projects. Currently, South Africa is the recipient of official donor funding from overseas countries that are our partners. And projects that qualify for this, they have to be in terms of an official development assistance agreement in terms of Section 2313 of the Constitution. So what we're doing in the provisions of the VAT Act, we were aligning them with the current provisions in the Income Tax Act. Because currently in the VAT, because a VAT is looking at a project and an enterprise. So what we are doing is that if you are the taxpayer doing a project and you are getting money in terms of the foreign donor-funded project, you must register each project differently because the issue is that each project has got its own agreement. So you cannot have a blanket registration of all the projects. And then we're going to also issue a guideline. SARS will be issuing a guideline together with Treasury as to how is the process going to be followed in this regard. And I'm going to hand over to France in terms of Section 72 of the VAT.
Thank you. One of the comments that has been quite strongly is that there's a number of fairly significant issues that have been covered by Section 72 in the past, which to our mind justify why we need to crush these out and put them in the legislation so that they are properly dealt with. But it does leave open the question of what do we do in the meantime. And so what we're suggesting here is that we create a transitional period, which we're currently running into 2021. So that we can look at those issues and then deal with them appropriately. And during that interim period, those rules would remain live. If they expire during the period, they can be renewed so that we can maintain the status quo for existing situations and then we can move forward. The next one was a more general comment that, well, you know, you now need to reduce the requirements that should be consistent with the policy construct of the actual provision and where you find that. And our response is, well, the well-known sector resources, so the overall scheme of the act. There's a number of textbooks and literature that would point you in the direction of things like this, but which is by the referenda, maybe others as well. Whilst that may not be decisive in interpreting that in the legislation, of course, that's certainly valuable in this particular arena where we can get into the policy direction that we should follow. So that would be our response here. At the Lorem, next slide, I'm going to have a very popular topic.
Thank you. Thank you, members. So we've been having consultations with the industry on this topic. We've met a lot of the vehicle manufacturers individually to discuss their business models and the impact. Part of the comments that they gave to us was that This really does create some uncertainty in the industry. There's, you know, the APDP and the previous MIDP were very stable incentives for a very long time. Now there is a sudden change, so it creates a level of policy uncertainty. So we have agreed to that view. There is a big change in the incentive now as the APDP moves into a new package of incentives called the SAM, the South African Automotive Master Plan. So that new incentive package is going to start from 2021. So we've agreed to delay this amendment up until the new SAM comes in 2021. The next point is just on the loss associated from this incentive. So in effect, what we are doing is we are increasing or reducing the value of the incentive because the ad valorem tax that they pay per vehicle now can't be offset by the rebates that they get. So in effect, they'd have to pay a higher tax on imported vehicles. So this wouldn't change the tax on locally produced vehicles, and it wouldn't change the tax on locally produced vehicles that are exported. So it only changes the tax on imported vehicles, but we recognize that you've got to look at the vehicle manufacturer as a whole, and it would have an impact on that vehicle manufacturer. So the proposal that we'd like to put forward is that we'd like to try and make this a revenue-neutral change. So if you saw the presentation earlier by Mercedes-Benz, it had this green arrow pointing up about big ad valorem duty that the country, the fiscus would get, but with all the negatives, we're trying to reduce that green big arrow to overall zero, to make it revenue neutral. So if you look at the industry as a whole, we wouldn't be taking more tax out of the industry. However, this would have other impacts, and the way to do this would be to reduce the ad valorem that you would pay on vehicles, so change the ad valorem structure, the tax, the luxury tax that you pay on vehicles, and to reduce it. So we'd get money from imported cars from the changes we're doing, and now we'll give it back through changing the ad valorem formula. So this would have differential impact on different vehicle manufacturers. So what we're proposing is that we engage further with stakeholders and with the Executive Oversight Committee, which was the committee that was set up to look at the move from APDP to SAM, to then try and get a decision on how we can change this formula in an appropriate way to be revenue neutral, to try and make an announcement in budget next year. Mohamed, do you want to add anything?
No, I think you've pretty much said everything. So we're making two changes. We agree that whatever's done should align with the new SAM, whatever that may be. And secondly, that, like Chris has said, it will be revenue neutral. So we will await the consultations in the Executive Oversight Committee. This issue has been flagged as an issue for discussion, I understand, in the past. Okay. That's what I've been told. And so we would get DTI and the car manufacturers to have a discussion. Hopefully, the sooner they reach agreement, the better, because we understand there needs to be certainty as soon as possible. And hopefully, we can then, if they complete their discussions before, preferably by December, they really push it to January, we can at least still make an announcement in the budget so there's complete certainty. So it's already a lower amount. That's certain. Okay. That green arrow is gone, as Chris has said. So that certainty is there. I think now it's just the kind of details on the lower amount that we're talking about.
All right, I think I'm back on the microphone. I'll try and keep this brief. So something that did pick up a fair amount of comment was the proposal around assisting people with interest or royalty payments. They were, of course, quite happy with this proposal, but as part of it, we introduced the concept of a two-year life of a declaration that is made in order to obtain a low withholding tax or an exemption. And we then made that consistent across interest, royalty, and dividends. And this is where the difficulty arose, because in the dividend space and to some extent in the interest space as well, there can be some very large number of foreign investors that would be impacted and a very large number of these declarations that would need to be refreshed. So, moving on to the next slide, there was a good deal of unhappiness about the idea of having to go back and do all of this. And we, in course of the public consultations we had, came up with an alternative, which is to say, well, if you're monitoring these declarations, so somebody says, well, I'm resident offshore in country X, and therefore I'm entitled to this reduced rate or this exemption, you should be monitoring that this person, in fact, still is in country X, that they're still involved with the particular investment as part of your Financial Intelligence Center or Common Reporting Standard obligations. If you're doing that, then you are making sure that that declaration is remaining current, that there's no reason to think that it is now obsolete, and so we would then not need to impose the two-year time limit in respect of the declarations and undertakings. So I think that would assist the large majority of what we call withholding agents, so they should be quite happy with that. You're then left with the rest who say, well, we still have a problem because this will come into force on a date that the legislation is promulgated. We're not quite sure when that is, so we're not quite sure when to start refreshing. Equally, though, we don't want to keep the people who are eagerly anticipating this amendment waiting for too long. So the proposal here is to have a deferred implementation date of the 1st of July next year, which gives people roughly 6 months to get with it and update their documents if necessary, and a six-month wait shouldn't be too much of a burden on people who are eagerly awaiting the change so that they don't have to get these things every time they make a payment. So we trust that's a useful compromise. Moving along to the sharing of information around carbon offsets and so on, there was a bit of pushback here. We don't need to share that information with the relevant other government departments because they'll just give us a certificate and that's the end of the story. Our experience is that that is not the end of the story. Sometimes we need to query things. Sometimes we may pick up anomalies. Maybe our data is incorrect. Maybe theirs is. So it's useful to have that interaction to make sure that we're all on the same page. And so we're not proposing to suggest or to withdraw the proposal that we can share the relevant information with those government departments. And I think that covers that slide. And, yeah, moving on. This also generated a little bit of unhappiness. This currently, there is a five-day notice period before you bring action against SARS. And we were proposing to extend that to 21 business days. That would be aligned with provisions in the Customs Act, and it's in fact would still be shorter than provisions in other legislation. But taxpayers are very uncomfortable with it. They believe that we should try and strike a happy median between the current five, which is the shortest I've been able to find, and the 21 we're proposing. So our proposal here is that we make it 10 business days, so that gives us 2 weeks to try and resolve the issues before we go to court, which I hope makes everybody happy, or at least equally unhappy. Then there were some questions around the so-called mandatory non-disclosure penalty. This is where schemes are put in place to try and get around the common reporting standard that I mentioned a little earlier. And so there are mandatory disclosure rules, which are internationally, there's model legislation on this. So we're essentially proposing there should be a penalty if you don't comply with those rules, which the minister will put in place by way of regulation. And the question here is it per account or per reporting period? The response is it's per scheme to get around the rules, which is what the rules talk about. And moving on to I think this is the last slide. There's a question around wording. There seems to be a bit of tension in the wording. In one place we use mandatory, in the other place we use required. The reason we use mandatory in the one place is so that there's a linkage with the international models, and then we go back to using the language we use everywhere else in the Tax Administration Act so that we're consistent. So we're trying to bridge that gap, and we think that's appropriate. And then finally, there's a question around whether we should use a static definition or a dynamic one. And we point out that, in fact, there is already such a definition in the draft regulations which are available. So there is a clear definition, and there's no question of dynamic versus static. And I think that's one last one. Criminal sanctions. Interestingly enough, there is a criminal sanction if you provide an erroneous, incomplete, or false document to another person to present to SARS, but not if you present it directly to SARS, which seems anomalous, so we suggested to fix that. Of course, someone has pointed out to us that when we did our memorandum of objects, we weren't complete, because you have to do this willfully and without just cause, and that's absolutely correct. So we will update the memorandum of objects so to make it clear to people who are reading it that if you make a bona fide inadvertent error, you're not going to be picked up by this, because clearly then it wasn't willfully and with just cause that you provided erroneous, incomplete, or false information. Last one now, definitely. And this is all around the tax compliance status of taxpayers. I think people are reasonably comfortable with what we're doing here. They're just trying to work their way through the legislation. So the first one is, well, can I apply for one myself? The legislation doesn't seem to talk to that. Well, you, of course, can. You have access to your own e-filing system. You can see whether you're compliant or not. The question here is, can I give that compliance status to third parties? So that's the critical point, and that's what we're covering in the legislation. Then there's a question around this 21 business day period we have to grant you that ability to give third parties access. And moving on to the next slide, we're confirming that once we've granted access, that's pretty much it's near real time. You give the PIN, as it is currently, to the third party. They use the PIN, they can see your compliance status. But why is there that 21-day period up front? That's so that we can check that we're comfortable that our records are sufficiently robust to support that compliance status. There may be some cases where there are issues that arise that indicate to us that there's a problem with this particular set of records and that perhaps we need to resolve them before we open up access. And then finally, and this is a pretty significant point, currently if you have a debt that has been suspended or that has been compromised or written off, that doesn't impact on your compliance status. Now, the question then is, what happens in that period where you have applied for a suspension but it has not yet been granted? In terms of the law, SARS cannot collect it, but the legislation on tax compliance status is silent about what impact that has on your compliance status, and we're proposing to say, yes, let's bring that in. If you have made that application and SARS is still considering it, just as we cannot collect it, so it shouldn't impact on your compliance status. So that should be something that taxpayers welcome.
Thank you, Chair. That's the medicine. It's over. On our side, over to your side.
Thanks, Commissioner Treasurer and SARS for the response. Members, questions, comments? Honorable Abrams?
Yes, sir. The only thing is that I'm not sure how the submission or the submitters feel now after the explanation. Maybe we need to hear a bit on that. However, my question is on slide number 19, according to the printed version. It's on the reviewing check treatment of surviving spouse death. I remember this one was it disturbed me last year in having been a newcomer in the committee as well and a victim of the spouse issues. But now I'm very sympathetic to the remaining spouses. And I think the Treasury has been very responsive in terms of accepting the proposal by the submission. And now it has pushed the proposed date from 2020 to 2021. Now my question is, what then is the impact on the survivors' funds? That's my question. A similar question I had on another submission, I hope I can find it, where an amendment is made by Treasury based on submission, but then again, when there are complaints on that amendment, Treasury withdraws. I don't know. Just talk to this me, Akalala. Because for me, there was reason for the amendment, you know, in as far as Treasury was concerned. But now, when there's more talk, you just simply withdraw the amendment. You remember that? So I really would like to have clarity around that. Thank you, Chair.
Are there more questions from members? So you can respond to the issue of the surviving spouse.
With regard to the issue of the surviving spouse, in the meantime, we have had discussions with GPF and SAS, because currently the legislation makes provision for the surviving spouse to go voluntarily to the retirement fund or insurer to say withhold more, so that at the end of the year I don't suffer a higher tax liability. So what in the meantime, currently there is that voluntary provision which is there. But also what you have seen is that it's more communication and it's more education. So we've had meetings with the surviving spouse together with the GPF mostly, because those were the ones that were affected. So we said we're going to keep on the communication, and SARS has written to us, to the surviving spouses, based on the information to see how can they assist. But before 2021, if the legislation is not there, it's up to the member to take an initiative and say withhold more or else set aside more money, so that at the end of the day, when you are pushed to the next bracket, you have more. But because now they are more educated, there is more communication in this regard, we think that this is going to be, but I don't know.
I think, you know, the problem is that many don't know still, however much we might reach out. So I guess we do, and we are constantly thinking of how to improve the impact. So I don't think this is, it's certainly not a comprehensive solution to the problem. It goes some step. There's a lot more education that needs to be done. And I think we're alive to looking at other proposals as well. So did you want to say something?
Thank you. Just on the delay, it's because we need to get, so SARS is the only one who knows whether you're getting both incomes. So they're going to have to pull this information together and then tell the insurers, transfer that information, that these are the people who have these two incomes, and then those insurers have to change their systems to then pay the correct amount of tax. So there's quite a lot of development on the systems that is needed, and they're not going to be ready by February at the start of the next tax year. So they're going to have to, they need to see the legislation and then spend money on getting these systems so that hopefully it's automated. But we, that's what we're telling with them, and that was the reason for the delay.
The withdrawing of the proposal, yeah, that's why I need taxation of long-term insurance, the second question, whereby we come with the proposal in the TLEP and then there are comments. Those comments were like counter-proposals to say that don't make it mandatory to all of us, to so that a risk policy that pays annuities goes to untaxed policy fund. That's what the lady said. So what they're saying, that don't make it mandatory to all of us, the provision, though it's administrative burden, but some of us don't feel the administrative burden. So they said, make it an election to say that each insurer will choose to apply this provision or not. And for SARS, we said, no, you came to us to say there's administrative burden. So now we are trying to assist you. You are saying now, make the provision an elective provision. Each insurer must choose whether to apply this provision. And also, this year, must I apply the following? So the election is like, which year to apply? Do you apply during your lifetime of your business, or do you apply, you make an election in each and every year of assessment? We don't know. So we said, okay, we have seen that this has never been an issue. So we're going to withdraw the proposal.
Okay. Thanks, Krishna Treasurer and SARS, for the responses. From here, the minister will table MTBBS on the 30th of October.
Yeah. So the issue, I guess, for you is that, or for the committee, is the minister may still feel X or Y he wants to amend. To the extent that he does that, we'll inform the committee when we table the bill, after we table. So we'll alert you to any changes. But otherwise, the approach you have, if you are broadly happy, we're not asking you to vote or anything, lays the basis for us then to do the final bill. You still have the opportunity, once the bill is tabled. There are precedents where changes are made, although we don't like it, because you have to then go through the procedures, the Money Bills Procedure Act process, once it's tabled. So we prefer to make the changes now.
Okay, thanks. That's the process. And then on the 19th of November, that's where there will be a consideration and adoption of the committee reports on the 2019 Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, 2019 Draft Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill, 2019 Draft Rates and Monetary Amounts and Amendment of Revenue Bills, and the 2019 Draft Income Tax Amendment Bill. If we can distribute the program, let them, the members have the program.
Just if I may come in, we're probably going to merge the income tax bill into the TLAB, so it will be three bills.
Okay. Yeah. And then, then we'll be done once we adopt the reports. I think, unless there's any other business, it's from stakeholders. What are the questions for?
Honourable Chair, just a question. The Honourable Member asked if the industry present today were to give their feedback and views on the proposed changes and their feelings. I just wanted to check with you whether that was something that was acceptable to you, or whether there's a separate forum for that.
We have taken our submissions last week and today. Treasury and SARS have responded, and as the committee will consider your submissions and the responses from Treasury, and then adopt the report then we'll conclude the process in that manner through the parliamentary processes. Because if we can open up now, every stakeholder is going to contest what is in the response, and we'll start afresh. And what I understood was that Treasury is still open to bilaterals and multilaterals in regard to specific issues that you have raised, like the following day after the adoption of the report on 20th of November, we are going to have a briefing by SARS on the illicit tobacco trade. And the tobacco industry is invited to come to that meeting, because meetings of the committee are open. And we'll still make follow-up on some of the issues that stakeholders have raised. But we haven't closed the avenue for engagement, both with the Treasury and SARS and with Parliament, until such time that the report gets adopted. So that should be the process. We'll try by all means to make sure that whatever we do is transparent and we don't lock out stakeholders, so that you feel agreed that with that stakeholders, SARS, National Treasury members, the meeting is adjourned.